Welcome to Waterford Soundwaves, a series of self-guided tours that will take you to some of the areas of interest in Waterford Township. You'll have an opportunity to walk through the history of Waterford and to visit some of the beautiful natural features that make Waterford such a special place. You can load these tours on your MP3 player and take them with you to the sites. You'll be given instructions when to start and stop the recordings to keep you synchronized with the areas you'll be viewing. As you follow along these tours, please remember to respect any private property you will be viewing or passing by, and please stay on the sidewalks or public pathways. This series was made possible thanks to the resources of the Waterford Historical Society, the technical assistance of Waterford's Media Network, and the support of the Waterford Area Chamber of Commerce. So, put on your walking shoes and let the adventure begin. Welcome to the Drayton Plains Nature Center. You're visiting one of the real gems in Waterford Township. Many schools maintain a nature center for their students' use, but they are typically 15 to 30 acres in size. Our nature center is a fabulous 137 acres of undeveloped land for your enjoyment. Some gear you may want to bring along on your tour includes a bird guide, a wildflower guide, or a tree guide. Binoculars may come in handy, and a pedometer would be fun. The pace of the recording assumes you will be walking at a comfortable speed. You will be walking on unimproved trails, so watch out for outcrops of rock, tree roots, and fallen limbs. You will circle the prairie and then backtrack to the fish rearing ponds. You set the pace. This tour should be a relaxing experience where you can enjoy all that the Drayton Plains Nature Center has to offer. The Nature Center was established in 1904 as a bass and bluegill hatchery. In selecting the site, the Department of Conservation, now the Department of Natural Resources, sent scouts throughout the state in search of the ideal water source, ponds, and land appropriate for development. The current site was found to be the only one in Michigan with the optimal conditions. And so it was that the state appropriated $2,250 to purchase 85 acres of land, buildings which included an unused grist mill, a dam, and all the water rights.
In the mid-1930s, the state renovated the hatchery. The old buildings were torn down and a grand plan was drawn up in which the Clinton River was split to flow around a 37-acre island on which the existing ponds were created. Work began in August 1935. Using local workers who are participating in the WPA. WPA is the Work Projects Administration, a relief program initiated by the federal government during the Great Depression to create work for people. The new building was completed in 1937 and had the capacity to incubate 17 million eggs indoors. The ponds were estimated to be able to yield over 500,000 bass and 5 million bluegill on an annual basis. With this production capacity, the hatchery became the largest of its kind in the world. Cutbacks in the early 1960s and a warming of the river's temperature brought about the closing of the hatchery. There was discussion about purchasing the property to use as the Civic Center for Waterford Township, but that did not fit in with the plans of the DNR. A grassroots movement headed by Don Richards of the DNR, arose to establish a nature center on the site. By a special act of the state legislature, the property became available for purchase by the newly incorporated Drayton Plains Nature Center. 82 acres were sold to the nature center in 1961 for $153,000, with the understanding that it would never be sold for development. An additional 55 adjacent acres were purchased from the Natural Science for Youth Association. Today, the Drayton Plains Nature Center property consists of 137 acres and has three active rearing ponds. These ponds were renovated in 1990 when the dikes were rebuilt and trees bulldozed out of the ponds. Fish are no longer hatched inside of the Nature Center building. Instead, it now houses wildlife displays and an interpretive center.
Our tour starts by walking left out of the parking lot of the Nature Center. After walking approximately 11 minutes, you'll reach the prairie, and after another 18 minutes, you should reach the fish-rearing ponds. At any point, you can stop the recording to catch up, or fast forward if need be.
We are walking in a lowland area. The type of plant life you see here includes oak, hickory, and silver maple trees, which are hardwood trees. You will also see buckthorn, which is a non-native species brought in by settlers for use as decorative hedges. When uncontrolled, it will take over an area and no ground cover will grow underneath it. So wildlife doesn't bed in the area, and there's nothing to eat there either. Another non-native you will see in patches in this area is garlic mustard. It was brought in by the settlers as a source of greens in the winter. You can find it growing even under the snow. It has heart-shaped leaves and a distinctive garlic smell, and it was used in salads and soups. Garlic mustard gets rid of the competing species by changing the chemistry of the soil to suit its needs, and discourages the growth of other species. You will pass a bridge on your right. You will cross that bridge to the other side of the river on your way back. There is an old tale of how the red and white oaks got their names. The red oaks have pointed lobes on their leaves, like arrows, and the white oaks have rounded lobes on their leaves, like bullets. So the tree with the pointed arrow-like leaves was named after the Native Americans and called red oaks, while the tree with the rounded bullet-like leaves was named after the white man. Who knows if the story is true, but it does make it easier to identify the trees when they are leafed out. Japanese honeysuckle, grapevine, and bittersweet are non-native plants introduced by its settlers for their decorative value. Grapevines often grow unchecked in natural areas, but they do not harm adjacent plants. The bittersweet and Japanese honeysuckle, however, pose intense threats to animal and plant life in any natural area. They strangle the plants they climb on, and their root systems choke out native species. Many times you can't tell ahead of time what species will cause problems when they are introduced to a new area.
In the marsh area on the left, there will be red twig dogwood and cattails, which provide a home for muskrats, salamanders, and frogs. You may also see garter snakes, river otters, and raccoons. And, even if you don't see them, deer abound in the Nature Center acreage. Occasionally, as you walk through this area on a warm spring day, you may see the garter snakes draped over the branches of the scrub in this area, sunning themselves. The sound of a bullfrog is a familiar one to many people. Their jug-o-rum call can be heard for more than a quarter mile on a quiet morning. Bullfrogs are the largest frogs in North America, growing to 8 inches. They start out as tadpoles, which will grow to 6 3/4 inches long and may take almost 2 years to transform. While they're in their tadpole state, they feed on algae and small plant materials. Bullfrogs will eat snakes, worms, insects, tadpoles, and other frogs. There are reports of bullfrogs eating bats as well. They prefer ponds, lakes, and slow-moving streams with sufficient vegetation to provide easy cover. A bullfrog's hunting style is sit and wait. They wait for some type of prey to come by, and then with the flash of a tongue, they grab it and pull it into their mouth. And they are prey for birds. They have a hard time avoiding them. Bullfrogs may bury themselves in mud and construct a small cave-like structure under the water for winter. The average bullfrog lives 7 to 9 years. Muskrats, unlike the verminous rat, seldom invade our space. They're never far from water and prefer marshy wetlands. Muskrats den in push-ups or mounds, which you will see on the left as you walk along the trail. They don't construct lodges like the beavers. Instead, they fashion mounds out of grasses, reeds, and a few small sticks. There is no structure below the water. Think of this lodge as a pile of warm grass the muskrat can crawl up into during the winter. After winter, they usually abandon their lodge and live in burrows on the banks of ponds. Like all rodents, muskrats are adept at tunneling into the earth. Muskrats graze on the bottom of ponds, eating clams, and unlike the beaver that crushes the shell, the muskrat neatly pries them open. Muskrats can swim well underwater, and they are powerful swimmers on the surface. Their tail is used for propulsion and steering.
The word salamander comes from the Greek for fire animal. According to popular myth in the Middle Ages, salamanders were born of fire. When people would set fire to damp logs, the salamander would scurry out of the log. The noisy frogs and toads are familiar to most people, but the silent and secretive salamanders are largely creatures of mystery. When salamanders are seen during their rare above-ground migrations, many people mistake them for lizards. However, they are not at all closely related to the lizards. Most salamanders live hidden under forest soils and leaf litter, or in some species, on the bottom of ponds, lakes, or streams. Salamanders can absorb water and even take in oxygen and release carbon dioxide through their thin skins. Most adult salamanders also breathe with lungs. Salamanders lay their eggs in masses under the water. After hatching, the salamander larvae retain visible gills and soon develop their front, then hind, legs. They feed on small aquatic animals, like insect larvae, and even on other amphibian larvae. Their transformation into the adult form takes place in mid to late summer. The gills and tail fins are absorbed, and lungs take over respiration. They then leave the water and hide in pond-side leaf litter. They remain fully carnivorous, feeding on worms, insects, small mice, and even smaller salamanders. As a defense against predators, salamanders have skin glands that will produce a distasteful or even poisonous substance. They can also drop portions of their tails, which will continue to wriggle and confuse the predator long enough to allow the salamander to escape. Later, they can regrow a new tail. Salamanders play an important part in the food chain in wetland and woodland habitats. They are predators on smaller creatures and in turn are eaten by a variety of larger animals. The largest salamander ever found was 5 feet long.
So, if you were dropped into the middle of the nature center as a survival exercise, what would you eat? Surprisingly, you can eat cattails early in their development. When the cattail is about 3 inches long, it is tender and very tasty. Also, you can eat milkweed plants. Only the stems and leaves are edible, and only until they are about 12 inches high. The pod has not formed yet. They have to be boiled in 3 separate pots of water to remove the bitter taste, but when they are finished, they taste like fresh peas. Many mushrooms are edible, but you better know your mushrooms before you eat any because many are toxic. You can eat acorns, but they are bitter. May apples, if they are ripe, are edible and taste good. The rest of the plant and unripened fruit are poisonous, and you can eat seeds from the various grasses. There are many other greens and roots that are edible or used for medicinal purposes in our nature center. If you are interested in more information, a book of wild foods and medicines is available for purchase from the nature center. As we walk toward higher ground, you will find black oat and wild blackberry, not edible cherries, sadly. This whole area is conspicuously missing trees between 50 and 150 years old. Speculation is that grazing cattle roamed the area in that 100-year time span and destroyed all the saplings. Watch the trees as you walk for fox squirrels, great horned owls, crows, blue jays, scarlet tanagers, and cardinals.
Forest stewardship is part of the custodial responsibility the Nature Center has. To that end, a survey was done in 1993 and a forest management plan was put together. It was determined that some of the larger trees should be removed to allow for growth beneath the canopy. In January 1999, the Drayton Plains Nature Center contracted with Paris North, a logging company in Elmira, Michigan, to weed out trees. Winter is the best time for this process when there are no leaves on the trees and the heavy equipment won't harm the forest floor. It's frozen. The Nature Center received $19,672 for allowing this logging company to remove pre-marked oak trees from the property. Nothing was wasted from these trees that were removed. The wood was used for flooring and furniture. The bark was used in landscaping, the sawdust was sold to farmers, and the wood chips were sold for pulp. At this point, you should be at the Prairie Restoration Area. As you climb the rise, you will see a trail to the left and an observation deck straight ahead. If you want to follow the path to the left for a short walk and turn around, or if you want to go down to the observation deck and bask in the serenity of the wetland area, turn off the recording and enjoy. Turn the recording back on and go to the right to circle the prairie when you are ready to resume the tour.
Before this area was settled, southern Michigan was mostly a savanna-type landscape with oak barrens, oak savannas, and prairies. There were about 150,000 acres of prairie lands at the time of the European settlement. Most were scattered across the southernmost three tiers of counties. A prairie landscape is a sea of grass with scattered trees and wild flowers. It contains a diversity of grasses, weeds, and wildflowers. The prairie flowered every few weeks from May through September. Seventy-5% percent of the weight of the prairie ecosystem's plants lay below the surface. This living earth is the essence of the prairie and accounted for its high productivity. Since a very small portion of the plant is above ground, the grasses are very resistant to fire and grazing. A single plant can live for centuries, even if the area is burned every few years. Wildfires held the large, dense tree growth in check in the prairies. After a wildfire burned through a prairie, ashes would enrich the soils. Seeds and root systems that required the scarification that a fire provides were able to germinate, and the prairie would start to green within about a week, and shortly after that, it would burst into bloom. Prior to widespread European settlement in Michigan, fires were commonly ignited by Native Americans or by lightning strikes. Because fires have been suppressed in our landscape for over 200 years, for protection of homes, cities, and crops. Michigan's prairies, savannas, and other fire-dependent ecosystems are quickly disappearing. The prairie was home to a vast array of butterflies, birds, including owls and prairie hens, as well as hawk and deer. It provided cover and camouflage for coyotes and foxes, and myriad small mammals such as the badger and vole. Farming quickly wiped out nearly all of the southern Michigan prairies, replacing them with pasture and cultivated fields. It was easier to clear the prairie than the forests. Plus, the dense root systems of the prairie grasses were cut into sod bricks for use in building homes for the settlers.
The prairie restoration area was developed to recreate an original prairie. The dense undergrowth was eliminated and non-native species were removed. Today, this work is done the hard way, with volunteers pulling them out by hand, or cutting branches and treating them to prevent regrowth. This laborious effort strives to recreate, in a limited way, the effects of a wildfire. However, a prairie burn is a legitimate way to maintain a prairie area. These burns are highly controlled tools that require coordination between the burn boss, the fire department, and trained volunteers. A burn prescription is written that spells out all the details, such as the maximum wind velocity and the required wind direction, the necessary weather conditions, and the exact area to be burned. A fire break is created around the prescribed burn area, and all combustible materials are removed from the break. Then the fire is set, and nature takes its course under close supervision. The prairie burn was last done on April 19, 1997. The Drayton Plains Nature Center, in cooperation with the Waterford Fire Department, the White Lake Fire Department, along with Michigan Wildlife Habitat and Michigan Nature Conservancy, conducted a 2-acre burn that started at 8 o'clock in the morning and ended around noon. The goals set for this burn were met, and our prairie flourishes. Prairie restoration is a slow process, and restoration areas will become more prairie-like as the years pass. They may never be exactly like Mother Nature's prairies, but they are an important step toward conserving a part of our heritage and one of nature's most unique wildlife habitats.
As you now continue walking around the prairie, you will see an observation deck on the left across the river. It was built by an Eagle Scout as a community service project. It overlooks wetlands. A wetland is land that can support wetland vegetation or aquatic life. Because they're so varied, wetlands can be difficult to recognize. Some are wet all of the time, and some may look completely dry most of the time. Types of wetlands include deciduous swamps, cattail swamps, wet meadows, emergent marshes, wet prairies, fens, and bogs. What you're looking at now is an emergent marsh and cattail swamp. For many plants and animals, wetlands are the only places they can live. For others, wetlands provide important food, water, or shelter. If you hunt, fish, birdwatch, or photograph wildlife, know that all of these activities are dependent on wetlands. Wetlands function as natural sponges that trap and slowly release surface water, rain, snowmelt, and floodwaters. and wetlands within or downstream of urban areas are particularly valuable. They counteract the greatly increased rate and volume of surface water runoff from pavement and buildings. Wetlands are important in this respect as flood control mechanisms. Wetlands also have important filtering capabilities for intercepting runoff from higher land. As the runoff water passes through, the wetlands retain excess nutrients and some pollutants and reduce sediment that would clog waterways and affect fish and amphibian egg development. In improving water quality through filtering, some wetlands maintain stream flow during dry periods, and many replenish groundwater. This is important to us in Waterford because we depend on groundwater for drinking. Because wetlands were regarded as wastelands, people thought of them as places to avoid, or better yet, eliminate. Because of this negative view, more than half of America's original wetlands have been destroyed. Only recently have we begun to understand the importance of the functions that wetlands perform. We now know that wetlands are, in fact, valuable natural resources. We should be at the fork where you will bear left and follow the river back the way we came. We will follow the river back to the bridge where we will cross to the rearing ponds.
The main branch of the Clinton River rises from wetlands in Springfield Township. A series of dams create a number of small lakes west of Pontiac, the last of which is Dawson's Mill Pond. The river is piped under downtown Pontiac, re-emerging on the city's near east side. The North Branch and the Middle Branch rise in northern Macomb County and join the main branch in Charter Township of Clinton, which was named after the river. The main branch flows 80 miles from its headwaters to Lake St. Clair. The Clinton River watershed drains 760 square miles, including most of Macomb County, a large portion of Oakland County, and small portions of Lapeer County and St. Clair County. More than 1.4 million people in over 60 municipalities live in the watershed. The river was renamed in honor of DeWitt Clinton, the governor of New York from 1817 to 1823. Previously, the river had been known as the Nottawississippi by the French and Native Americans. The English referred to it as the Huron River of St. Clair. It was referred to as the River Huron in the 1784 home eulogy of the area's first white settler, William Tucker, who built his home along the river about 3 miles upstream. The name was changed on July 17, 1824, by the Michigan Territorial Council to avoid confusion caused by the many other places known as Huron in eastern Michigan, including the Huron River, which rises in adjacent Oakland County. The same legislative act also changed the name of Huron Township in Macomb County to Clinton Township. We are now at the rearing ponds. You can stop the recording and go left to the observation deck you observed. Or, if you choose to follow the tour, then turn right.
There were originally 11 rearing ponds at the hatchery. There are only 3 in use today, numbers 6, 7, and 8. The first 5 were smaller ponds near Hatchery Road that have been allowed to grow over and are hardly recognizable as ponds. And pond number 3 was lost when Hatchery Road was widened. There are three you see here in the middle that are in use, and then another three to the left which are overgrown with a non-native grass called Australis phragmites, or common reed. This non-native species quickly encroaches on wetlands and can potentially dry them up. You've seen it along roadsides and in ditches, certainly. To propagate, it sends runners under the ground, so it is almost impossible to remove from an area once it is established. Each of these active ponds are used to rear a single type of fish, one for northern pike, one for red-eared sunfish, and one for walleye.
On April 1st, the ponds are gravity-fed water from the upper branch of the Clinton River and filled. It takes a few days for the ponds to fill completely. About the third week in April, 100,000 walleye fry are brought in from the Wolf Lake State Fish Hatchery when they are 5 days old. They are about a quarter of an inch long and will be harvested out of the ponds and stocked into local lakes in June when they're about an inch and a half long. You can see samples of each stage of walleye development on display in the Nature Center. The fish feed on zooplankton, commonly called daphnia, that are present naturally in the river. The zooplankton feed on phytoplankton, or green plants, which is a product of photosynthesis. Its growth is spurred on with the treatment of fertilizer during the fish rearing weeks. If there are too many cloudy days in a row, the phytoplankton will not reproduce and the fish will not have enough food to eat. So if the food source appears to be inadequate, the fish may be removed ahead of schedule. But if all goes well, the walleye fingerlings are netted out in June and stocked into local lakes. A typical walleye will be about 6 inches long after their first year of growing and average 25 inches long as an adult. Walleye are netted out of the ponds. This netting process uses 24 nets and takes 2 days to complete. The habits of the walleye make it a fairly easy task. Large nets are placed in the ponds with leads that are attached to the shore. The walleye follow the lead, thinking it's the shoreline, and they swim right into the nets. They are then lifted out, weighed, and loaded onto trucks. Fish become stressed once they're loaded onto the trucks, so they are quickly taken to one of the 12 county area lakes that are due for stocking from our hatchery.
When a lake is first stocked with fish, the fingerlings are brought in every year for 3 years in a row to establish a quick population. After that, they go on a rotation schedule and are stocked only every other year. Stocking every other year will prevent these fish populations from running out of things to eat. If an overpopulation of a species in a lake occurs, cannibalism could very well result. Red-eared sunfish are reared in the second pond. They are brought in as adults and spawn their young in the ponds, and then they are all removed together. Sunfish are opportunists at a young age and will eat almost anything, but as adults, they eat primarily snails. Therefore, these fish are stocked in snail lakes, such as Union Lake and Tipsico Lake, which are lakes with a large snail base. Since snails are a large part of their diet, they don't do well in lakes without snails. They were stocked unsuccessfully in Cass Lake, where the snail population was too small. Sunfish will also eat zebra mussels, so there is a native predator for this non-native guest in our lakes. Unfortunately, the sunfish don't eat enough zebra mussels to eliminate them from our waterways. A trophy-sized sunfish will grow to as large as 12 inches long. Pike fry are brought in early April and are taken out in June. The pike fry also eat zooplankton, but once they become adults, they are serious carnivores. Northern pike can have a significant impact on their prey species. Pike lurk in the cover of vegetation in the lake's clear, shallow, warm waters near shore. They consume large numbers of smaller fish. Fish make up about 90% of their diet, but they seem willing to supplement their diet with any living creature their huge jaws can surround, including frogs, crayfish, waterfowl, rodents, and other small mammals. Their preferred food size is approximately one-third to one-half the size of the pike itself.
Sunfish and pike are net-shy fish, so taking them out of the ponds is a totally different exercise. They are drained out. Near the bridge that crosses over the Nature Center buildings, as well as several other places at the river's edge, you will see concrete collection boxes. The plug is pulled on the pond, and the water runs through one of these collection boxes and into the lower arm of the Clinton River. The fish are detained in the collection box and netted out at that point. They are weighed to determine how many fish are being removed and loaded into a truck. This process must be done quickly because as you drain the pond, the shallow water exposes the fish to view. It doesn't take the 20 or 30 resident egrets long to discover that dinner is served. An impressive aerial feeding frenzy ensues, so you can see why speed is essential if you are to save as many fish as possible. This draining process takes about 4 hours. If you are lucky enough to be walking in the park on the day in June when this pond is drained, you will see this wonder for yourself. After the ponds are drained, the DNR brings their tractors and mow the plants that are growing in the pond and mow the vegetation on the sides of the dikes. Mature tree roots can pierce the dikes and cause leaks, so the growth of vegetation is strictly controlled on the dikes. The ponds are again filled for instructive use by the Nature Center and eventually drained for the winter and given one last mowing.
Our hatchery is one of the most cost-efficient the DNR has. No pumps are needed because the filling and draining are all done by gravity. It costs only about 2 cents to rear a walleye in our hatchery. The filling tubes have all been replaced, upgraded to plastic tubes from the old cypress tubes, which were originally installed in the 1930s. Cypress tubes were simply cypress logs with a hole bored through the center to act as piping. If you continue straight on this path, you will reach the dam at Hatchery Road that controls the amount of water flow in the Clinton River. If you turn left and walk between the ponds, you will cross another dam and enter the Pine Flats. There is a trail that loops through the pine trees and brings you back to the river's edge. You can turn off the recording and follow either of these paths, turning the recording on again when you return to the bridge. As you cross the bridge and return to the parking lot, you will see a log cabin on the edge of the river. It was built in 1939 on the site where Canterbury on the Lakes now sits on Hatchery Road. Over the years, it housed members of the Windler family, the property's various caretakers, and a Latvian couple who were displaced by World War II. In the early 1990s, when Canterbury on the Lake purchased the property, the log cabin was sold and moved to Rose Township, but that proved to be only a temporary stop. It was then donated to the Drayton Plains Nature Center and moved to its current location in 1995, just 3 days before Christmas. If you look closely at the cabin, you will see that it is sitting on steel beams. Those beams span an unused hatching pond. It was easier to set the cabin here than to fill in the unused pond.
In 2000, the Drayton Plains Nature Center was in dire financial condition and a proposal was considered to sell off 5.5 acres of development land in order to meet current and future operating expenses. It was estimated that the property could be sold for $500,000. The public outcry was huge and the sale never occurred. Instead, a partnership was created between the Nature Center, Waterford Schools, and Waterford Township. In 2003, an Environmental Protection Act grant for $750,000 was given to the Drayton Plains Nature Center to establish a permanent conservation easement on this property. The agreement has left Waterford Township as deeded owners and responsible for maintenance of the property. Waterford School District has contracted with Oakland County Parks and Recreation to provide educational opportunities for the Waterford School children. And the Oakland Land Conservancy received part of the grant to ensure the conservation easement is strictly followed. It is now protected in perpetuity from development.
Now that you know the lay of the land, return to the Nature Center and enjoy a walk accompanied only by the sounds of nature. A stroll through the Drayton Plains Nature Center is a different experience as the seasons change. Come back and revel in the changes that each season brings. Along with walks at your leisure, you can also participate in seasonal events, such as maple syrup tapping in early spring and a haunted hayride in October. If you've enjoyed this tour and want to support the Nature Center, you can become a friend of the Nature Center for a nominal fee. To find out more, contact Waterford Parks and Recreation Department at 248-674-5441. Also, watch for the recreational program offerings in the Leisure Services brochure from Waterford Parks and Recreation. If you're interested in helping the effort to remove non-native species and invasive species from the park, you can contact the Oakland Land Conservancy at www.oaklandlandconservancy.org to sign up. Thanks for joining Waterford Soundwaves at the Drayton Plains Nature Center. Check out the other tours available at Waterford Township's website, www.twp.waterford.mi.us.